It's time now for the Todd Leonard Show. Leave those negative stories behind as we focus on the positive and hear from those who give back and help others. Let's start your day with some inspirational stories. Now, here's your host, Todd Leonard.
Good morning, everyone. We have an amazing show. We're going to be talking with two wonderful ladies who are really a huge part of the Seeing Eye. The Seeing Eye right here in Morristown has been empowering, enhancing independence, dignity, and self-confidence for almost a century. Almost a century. It was founded by Morris Frank, a blind person, with a co-founder, a lovely lady, Dorothy Eustace, who is from Switzerland. And this is a remarkable story. But the amazing thing is they've been helping so many people over the many years, and also all the wonderful volunteers. It's a great honor today. We have Melissa Allman, an accomplished lawyer who's a graduate of the Seeing Eye. Graduated in 2017. We can't see right now, but we have our lovely partner, Luna, who's actually really a beautiful dog. And we also have Michelle Barlack, who's been with the Seeing Eye for over 12 years, a senior public relations specialist. So it's going to be a really interesting show, a very uplifting show. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Thank you so much, you know, for coming in this morning. You know, each show I try to bring on interesting people, interesting causes, just to kind of enrich all of our lives. So, you know, Michelle, I was doing a lot of research about this thing. And, you know, I live in the area. I know in Morristown, there's this incredible statue.
Yes.
And in doing research, I understand that the statue of Morris Frank and also his guide dog, Buddy. Tell us a little bit about the origination of the Seeing Eye, since obviously I know you know a lot more than I'll ever know about the Seeing Eye. Tell us a little bit about how it started and why.
Sure. So the Seeing Eye was founded 93 years ago in 1929. And the origination of the Seeing Eye came about a little bit by accident. It's an interesting story. Dorothy Harrison Eustace was an American from Philadelphia. She was living in Switzerland with her husband, George Eustace, and they were breeding and training German shepherds for the Swiss police. And the Saturday Evening Post asked her to write an article about her training program. And she said to them, well, you know, I don't really want to write about what I'm doing because I don't want to get flooded with letters from people asking me to train dogs for them. I'm really interested in this program in Germany where they're training German shepherds to guide blinded World War I veterans. They had been blinded by mustard gas. So I'm going to go and I'm going to check that out, take photos and write an article, which she did. But what ended up happening was she received letters from people asking her to train guide dogs for them. Out of all the letters that she received, Morris Frank's letter to her was the only person who said, I want to take this and I want to help other people. So Morris Frank was blinded in two separate accidents, a horse riding accident and later in a boxing match, and had been working as an insurance salesman in Nashville, Tennessee. And he'd been guided by young people, usually young men, who he would hire for the day, and they would take him to his appointments as an insurance salesman. And it was really difficult for him because these people would extort him. They'd take him to a location and then they'd say, well, I won't take you home unless you increase my pay, or they'd get bored and they'd just leave him stranded. And it was very frustrating for him. So he wrote to Dorothy and he said, I want to help other people like me. If you will train a dog for me, I will come back to the United States and I will start a school and I will help as many people as I can. And she was so moved by that. So she initially tried to find a dog, someone who would train a dog for him in the United States, and everyone told her she was crazy and that couldn't be done. Well, you didn't tell Dorothy no, and you didn't tell Morris no. So when these two people got together, they did amazing things. And so she got Morris. She found a way to get Morris to Switzerland. That's a whole other story. But she got him to Switzerland, and she matched him with a dog named Kiss. And Kiss was a female German shepherd. All of Morris's Seeing Eye dogs were German shepherds. And he changed her name to Buddy because he did not want to call a dog Kiss in public. And all of his dogs after that were named Buddy.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating story. And what I heard and was reading about Morris was he was so excited, so thrilled to have the independence, enhancing the independence and the dignity that I know he penned a letter to his mom, right? And
Melissa, yes.
I know that, you know, Melissa Allman, you're a graduate of the CNI, and there's so many, I have so many questions for you because number one, in getting ready for the show, I'm an attorney. I understand you're an accomplished lawyer, and it's just so fascinating on so many levels. So, you know, Melissa, when I was thinking about, you know, your journey and why I was so excited and so honored that you're going to join us today, you're a graduate of the CNI, right here in Morristown.
Yes.
Can you kind of walk us through, because like you said, there's so many wonderful things I want to go over with you, but how did that all come about? So before you were involved with this wonderful organization, the CNI, how would you get around in terms of just, you know, going through life?
Well, that's a great question. So I was born blind. I have an eye condition called Leber's congenital amaurosis. It's a genetic condition. And I have never really had any vision to speak of other than a little bit of light perception. So pretty much most of my life, when I was old enough to do so, I used a white cane. You know, that's the traditional white cane that many people see blind people traveling with. And you can move it in different ways. You can have it at a diagonal to your body. You can sweep it back and forth. There are techniques that are very specific to help you use the cane effectively. And a cane is an object avoider. An object detector. Okay. So a cane, you move the cane so that you can find objects and get tactile information. So that's what I did until pretty much, and I'm going to give this away here, but I was almost 40 years old when, for a number of reasons, I decided it was time for me to start working with a guide dog, preferably a seeing eye dog, because I'd had some exposure to the seeing eye at that point. I had moved to Chicago. I was practicing law there, and I was living in this amazing and fascinating city with a lot going on, a lot of things moving quickly in the chaotic city environment, a lot of unexpected objects and things that would be in my way just traveling down the sidewalk. And although I could function fine with my cane and do so independently, I wanted empowerment. I wanted to swiftly and efficiently move around objects instead of finding them. And I wanted to approach street corners with purpose and feel like I could cross safely, even if a car was turning in front of me that I wasn't expecting. And that's when I made it my mission to do what I needed to do to make sure that my orientation and mobility skills, my cane skills, my ability to listen to and judge traffic were strong enough that I was in a good position and a good candidate to apply to work with a seeing eye dog. And there are some very specific reasons. There are a number of guide dog schools, but it was very important to me to apply to the seeing eye and have the privilege of going there to be matched with a guide.
You know, once again, so the seeing eye right here in Morristown is really the best in the world. Everything that I've researched in advance of the show, this is it. This is the pinnacle of folks that want a seeing eye dog. That's the place to be. Melissa, I'm just curious. I mean, you know, you're very intelligent. We had a pre-interview and I was really struck by you're very, very intelligent. Why did you become a lawyer?
Well, so it's kind of a funny story. I was getting my PhD in Russian literature. I had begun the program. I'd finished the master's program, and I was a teaching assistant. You know, that was how I ate a lot of pasta, you know, because back then graduate students, it's a pretty lean budget when you're a TA. And so I was just living my life and reading Russian literature, studying it. It was something that I was very motivated by. And I enjoyed it, but there was a need that I had that was not being met, not being fulfilled. And that was to help other people. And I was, of course, inspired by the Russian professors that I had and felt that their dissemination of knowledge was valuable to me. But I needed to serve. And I did not feel that once I finished the PhD program, and jobs are very scarce in that field, I didn't feel that that need of mine was going to be met. So I decided to take a sharp left turn and leave my PhD program that I'd spent a lot of time prepping myself mentally for, and go to law school. So that's when I decided to go to Temple Law School with the direct aim of doing public interest work. And that's where I stayed.
Wonderful. I mean, I love people that on life's journey, you realize you're not being fulfilled, that there's a bigger calling in life, and we all have gifts. And that's what was also just so striking, Melissa, when I know how passionate you are about advocating for folks that don't have a loud voice, and you're very competent. I know you were in the, you know, the fair housing area to help folks, and now you're serving so ably with the Seeing Eye, which I think is a wonderful fit. So, Michelle, there's a lot of dog lovers out there.
Absolutely.
I mean, I realize, you know, my wife, we had a whole debate again last night. We're blessed with two young kids. It's almost every other week we have these debates if we're going to have a dog or not. You know, it's a lot of responsibility. But I know the kind of dogs that you're going to partner up with the students, they're special dogs. So for the listeners, how does it work? So if someone wants to, let's say, apply to the Seeing Eye, I mean, do they just send an application? Do they call? How does it work for, let's say, someone, a blind person, and they hear wonderful things like, you know, Morris Frank learned so many, like almost a century ago. How does that work?
Sure. And Melissa, feel free to jump in here. We have a really thorough application process. It starts with the applicant first making an inquiry. They have application and medical forms that they have to do. And then we want to make sure that the person who is applying for the dog is going to be able to work with the dog enough to benefit from the dog. So there are varying types and degrees of blindness. But if you're able to see enough to interfere with the dog's work, over time you can untrain the dog. So we want to make sure that it's a really good fit. And then we also evaluate the person's, how much the person will have use for the dog. Are they traveling to a job? Are they traveling to school? Do they have places to go with the dog where the dog is going to be able to guide them? The dog doesn't help them live in their home. A lot of people think that a Seeing Eye dog helps the blind person do a lot of various things that a blind person really can do on their own. They give the dogs more credit than really what the dogs are trained to do. The dog helps the person travel from place to place. So the person has to be traveling places, essentially. And then, you know, the other important aspect of it is making sure the person is prepared to care for the dog and provide a safe environment for the dog. And then we bring them to our school. Well, first we visit them, and then we bring them to the school, and they stay with us, and they train with the dog. If it's their first dog, it's 25 days. And it's really important to make sure that that time is invested so that the person and the dog can appropriately bond. Because the dog works because it loves its handler and it wants to protect the team. And so it's not a matter of, a lot of people think that the Seeing Eye dogs from person to person might be interchangeable. You don't just walk up to a dog as a stranger and pick up the harness handle and say forward and the dog will take you across the street safely. That is a bond that happens first, and then the training. When someone's returning for a new dog, they still, you know, to replace a dog, they still stay for 18 days because that bond is so important. And we really believe in that. You know, the other part of that is when the person stays with us with the dog, we meet all of their needs. So they might have to fly in to train with the dog. We cover all of that. So they come and they stay with us. We have a dormitory, kind of like a hotel type setup. And we have staff that will make sure that, you know, their dining needs are met. They don't have to worry about food. All they need to focus on is training with and bonding with their dog. And And when they go home with that new partnership, we're there for them for the lifetime of the partnership. And an interesting fact is, I'll throw out here, you know, we've been around since 1929, and we've made over 17,700 partnerships.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I want to say a couple things about this from my perspective, because everything that Michelle said is what I've experienced. So when I was ready to come to the Seeing Eye, I had to be open to having a bond with a Seeing Eye dog. There was a long time in my life where I would not have been a good candidate for a guide dog because I wasn't interested in the responsibility. I wasn't emotionally prepared for that bond. But this is a labor of love on the part of the dog, like Michelle said. Luna and I have now been working together for 5 years. And when she guides me, it's up to me to know that it's time to cross the street because the parallel traffic has begun to surge. And obviously you don't want to go with the traffic that's cutting you off perpendicularly in front of you. But it is up to Luna to intelligently disobey me if she sees that there's something that is not safe and to not go forward. And then if we get halfway across the street and there's a car in the middle of the crosswalk and she has to guide me around it so that we can get safely to the other side, I have to trust her to do that. But it took time to develop that bond. And one of the things that was important to me coming to the Seeing Eye was to recognize, and it was a very humbling experience, because I had to recognize that I knew nothing. I was there to get my first dog, and I was meeting all of these people that were in class with me that had a lot of experience working with Seeing Eye dogs. And I learned a lot from them about things that would be helpful to do, things that wouldn't be helpful to do. I also learned, and this too was very humbling, that my perspective was just one. Blindness is a spectrum, right? So you've got people like me who are kind of what has been termed the vanilla blind, right? Just the standard, we don't see really anything to speak of. And I was pretty much born blind. They think I had a little bit of vision before I was 6 weeks old, possibly, but I couldn't talk about it, obviously. And then you have people who have very recently lost their vision, either suddenly or gradually, or they're in the process of losing it. And so they have to work a little bit harder at doing things that will keep them from interfering with the dog's work. So for me, I just had to trust that even though I didn't have the same amount of tactile information that I had with my cane, and I couldn't reach out and feel things with it, that Luna would take care of guiding me around things safely. And for one of my classmates, his breakthrough came the day he decided to stop trying to look down at his dog and just close his eyes and trust him. So that's a broad spectrum, and so are lifestyles. I was practicing law. I was going to court. I had to be in very different types of situations often. I had to go to a court I'd never been to a week and a half after I came home with Luna, and it was an uncomfortable experience because it was outside of my comfort zone for sure. But Luna was there to guide me safely. And then you have people who maybe they've been working with Seeing Eye dogs for 40 years or 50 years even, and now they've retired and they're slowing things down a little bit because they want to. And then you may have someone who lives in a rural area and has no interest in that fast-paced urban life that just does not appeal. So dogs have to be suited to the person and to their lifestyle. And so just to come to class for me was truly an honor and truly humbling.
Yeah, that's something we kind of glazed over, is the matching process that takes place between the people and the dogs. It's really important, and that's taken into consideration during the application process. And one of the big reasons we fly someone out from our staff, if the person isn't local, to evaluate their home environment, because we want to see where will the dog be living, where will the dog be working, what kind of work will be expected of the dog, because that is going to affect the kind of dog we place with that person. Just like people have a preferred speed at which they like to go about life, so do dogs. And so it's important to make sure that those personalities and those preferences are matched up.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I was really enjoyed in our pre-interview was the concept of the partner and the teamwork. and how it really has to be a bond. And the more I was thinking about it, that does make a lot of sense, because if you have a dog that is not going to temperament wise or whatever with the handler, you're going to have a mismatch, and that, that could have, you know, catastrophic consequences on a number of levels. So, Michelle, one of the things also that was of interest is the dogs themselves. Now, Luna is really, I'll be honest, I mean, Charlie doing a great job here, you know, with the camera. Didn't even realize there was a dog in the room. I mean, he's like, you know, what's going on? Whoa, hold on. There's a guide dog here. And we're going to go over the etiquette in a moment, how to, you know, deal with, you know, when someone's out in the field, let's say, with a guide dog. But is there a special kind of breed that the seeing eye has? Because what I was researching, not every dog would be qualified to be a guide dog. How does that work in terms of how the seeing eye has the right kind of breed for the handler?
Yeah, that's a good question. A lot of people ask us about why we use the breeds that we use. So we use Labrador Retrievers, Golden Retrievers, and German Shepherds. We also breed a cross of the Labrador and the Golden strictly for genetic diversity in our breeding program. And we have our own breeding program for the dogs so that we can ensure the best health, temperament, and trainability. And those are really the three things that led us to these breeds. Size is also a factor. A Chihuahua wouldn't be really effective at guiding somebody. You'd probably step on the dog. So the dog needs to be substantial enough to guide the person. They guide by pulling. But they also need to be small enough that they can fit under your seat, on a bus, or on an airplane. So for that purpose, larger breeds like a Great Dane wouldn't really be appropriate. And I think that shepherd enthusiasts would probably notice that our shepherds tend to be a little bit smaller than average, although we do occasionally get some larger shepherds, which are appropriate for the graduates who need those. So there's a full range of personalities and temperaments within those three breeds that help us meet the needs of our graduates.
So, Melissa, when you're coming here to Morristown to obviously go through the school, the seeing eye school, and you are going to then be placed and matched with Luna. And Luna is an incredible dog. Everything that I know about the way you've lived in your life and just meeting Luna today and the incredible temperament. What was that like, that experience? I'm guessing it was like an unknown because you never had a guide dog before.
Yeah.
Was it love at first sight in terms of like the feel and the way you interacted with Luna?
Well, that's really interesting because when I sat in my room, and this is how it goes when you wait for your dog, I sat in my dorm room on the floor because I wanted to make sure that I was down there at the dog's level when it arrived. I didn't know what the gender was going to be. I didn't know what the breed was going to be. I was very clear that I wasn't going to express a preference. Some people do, but I didn't think I knew enough, you know, to know what the best dog was for me. So I wanted to make sure that I was as open as possible to the match. So I was sitting on the floor and my instructor knocked on the door and she opened it and she came in with this like bouncy dog on a leash. And she said, Melissa, this is Luna. She's a yellow lab golden cross and she's your seeing eye dog. And I couldn't even believe it was real. I couldn't even believe it was happening. And then she released Luna to come over to me and gave me the leash. And the first thing Luna did was lick my ear. And we just spent some time snuggling and bonding. But one of the things that I will say is that I don't think Luna needed to, I really had to earn her love and trust a little bit. Some dogs I think are just love at first sight, and Luna liked me just fine, but I think that at first she could sort of take me or leave me, and I was a little concerned about that. I mean, she's very friendly, but if I left the room for a minute when we did the exercise where we had to leave our dogs in the crate for a few minutes and to kind of address any potential separation anxiety, other people's dogs were whining, and Luna was just like, see ya, peace out, you know. And so I said to my instructor, I don't think Luna likes me very much. And she said she will.
you know, she's one of those dogs that is, she needs to size you up, and she's doing that. So, and I was a little, at first, anytime we'd be outside and I would be trying to get her to go to the bathroom or to focus on something, and my instructor would come up, the person that trained Luna, and immediately Luna's attention would just be glued on her. And so, you know, that was a little hard for me at first, but I will tell you, the very last day of class, we went bowling because it was an activity. I am the worst bowler on the planet, but we had a classmate who wanted to do that, and we worked in pairs. So that was important to her. So I got to go along for the ride, and that was fine because then I could try to improve my bowling game, which wasn't successful, but I could also expose my dog to loud noises and see how she reacted to that, which turned out to be very important. But so I left Luna kind of tethered to a chair so that I could walk onto the, you know, onto the area where you bowl. And I did that with guidance from an instructor. And so then when I was bowling and then I came back to my chair, my instructor said, Melissa, I want to tell you something. The time that you were away from her, even just for those few steps, her eyes never left you. They were on you the entire time. So that was the beginning. That was just the beginning of our bonding. And as far as walking with her, working with her, when I picked up that harness handle and I had to trust her to guide me around things instead of using my cane, I was just fascinated because I was like, why is she making these different movements? Why are we going to the left? Why are we going to the right? And I was told things like, well, she just guided you around a tree, or there was a garbage can, so she took you right around that. Oh, there's a newspaper on the sidewalk and she took you around that. So instead of having to encounter these things, I just didn't even have to know they were there, which for me was nothing like anything I'd ever experienced. And when you're being guided by a human being, it's different because that person has a purpose in life that isn't just to guide you. They are a human being who has offered you assistance, and most of the time with love and care. But to have a being whose purpose in life is to guide me so that I can have autonomy was just something that took me a while to wrap my head around, and something that I don't ever want to go back. I want this lifestyle forever.
Well, it's an amazing relationship, and I know the bond is incredible. You're very, very close with Luna, and Luna's a beautiful dog. Luna's under the table for all the listeners, just so we all realize where Luna is.
And just to say something about that, Todd, you know, the greatest compliment to a guide dog team is when you're at a restaurant and you get up and everybody's like, oh, there's a dog under the table. I didn't know there was a dog there. Or you get off the airplane, and except for the people sitting around you or the flight attendants, all these passengers are like, I didn't know there was a dog there. So that's how it's supposed to go.
It's incredible. And that goes back to the enhancing the dignity and the self-confidence, because everybody wants to be treated equally. And I think it's a beautiful thing that the Seeing Eye does. So, Michelle, going back to the dogs are incredible, you know, the breeding. And I understand, like, because I live in the area, work in the area. I know you have a wonderful, very expansive campus there in Morristown.
We do.
And I understand that the breeding is done in Chester. But one of the things, and the reason why I do my show, is about the journey giving back those that volunteer their time and things that lift up the community, and certainly the Seeing Eye does. But let's say the dogs. I really want to talk about the dogs and the wonderful volunteers, because I think that makes such an integral part of the Seeing Eye.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to go to that subject in 30 seconds. Please join us once again. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.
Thank you for coming back. I mean, we're having an amazing show. Michelle, I was talking about the volunteers because I know how critically important they are to the success of the Seeing Eye. So when there's a beautiful little pup, right? At some point, I understand there's incredible volunteers that step up and they really help out. How does that work?
So we have about 500 families throughout New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania and a few in Delaware and Maryland who volunteer their time to raise our puppies. And it's such a selfless act because they get our puppies around 8 weeks of age and they keep them for about their first year. And between 14 and 16 months of age, the dogs come back to the CNI, and that's when they are at the best age to start their formal training. But when they're with the puppy raisers, they're learning really important foundational skills. They're learning obedience. They're learning to socialize in multiple environments. They take their puppies on outings, on trains, to museums, to stores, to get them acclimated to the places where they will be eventually accompanying their handler. And they also teach them house manners and basic obedience skills. And that's all really important foundational stuff that these people do as volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredible. And I didn't get a chance, maybe Michelle or Melissa, if they want to, they're listening to the show, and hopefully we're motivating and intriguing the incredible listeners. How do they reach the CNI if they want to get involved?
So you can call the CNI at 973-539-4425, or you can email us at info@cni.org. In addition to puppy raisers, which we are always recruiting, we also have on-campus volunteers. The on-campus positions are a little bit limited at the moment due to COVID, but there are still things that our volunteers can do from home to help remotely. So we don't want to discourage volunteers, but puppy raising is really where we need more volunteers at the current moment.
So one of the things that I found really striking is the bond that, you know, these incredible volunteers have with the puppies. I mean, these are incredible dogs, but they also know, because it becomes part of their family, they also know the dog is going to be returned and then they're going to get placed.
Yep.
And that they're going to find a new home. You know, they're going to be a guide dog and playing a vital role in that individual's life, the handler's life. Melissa, what's your thoughts about that? Because, I mean, I know how much you love and adore Luna, but for the volunteers that, you know, they have to bring the dog back.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, I'm extremely, extremely grateful to Luna's puppy raisers. I don't know who they are, because one of the things about the CNI is that the CNI protects the privacy of the graduates and the puppy raisers. So you don't know the identity of your dog's puppy raiser, and they do not know your identity. And social media has sort of changed that a little bit to some degree, but it's an important thing to respect if both parties want that. But I will say that what Luna's puppy raisers did by providing that foundation and this very sound dog that I received, you know, they had to give this amazing dog back to the seeing eye. But what they did doing that is changed my life forever. I mean, my life will never, even when Luna, I mean, she's seven and she's agreed to turn six again so that she can, you know, not keep getting older. But let's just say that doesn't happen. And it comes time for my successor dog. Luna will always be the dog that changed my life forever. So that's how I feel about our puppy raisers. And I can't thank them enough. We continue, like Michelle said, to need puppy raisers. And I know a little tiny bit about what it feels like, because before I was matched with Luna, I had the opportunity to raise a puppy for the seeing eye, and we had to give him back. And it was difficult. It was very, very difficult. But I knew that someday, assuming that I was a successful candidate, that someone was going to do that for me.
Yeah, I mean, once again, this is why I was so intrigued having you ladies on. Not only is this thing I doing incredible things, enhancing independence, enhancing dignity, and bringing more self-confidence, but the wonderful volunteers. So, Michelle, I also know in researching, you Seeing I has a huge budget. I mean, I was, wow. I mean, it's a lot of money to keep this incredible, well-renowned organization so functional and really a trailblazer. How much does it cost on an annual basis for this thing to provide these wonderful services?
So our operating budget is currently close to $28 million. And if you break that down, the cost of one partnership is it's over $71,000 currently. And those numbers were pre-inflation. So these numbers were calculated at the end of our last fiscal year. I'm sure this is going to change. And the cost, what's amazing about this is the cost to our graduates for someone like Melissa to come to the CNI for their first dog, it's $150. That's what we charge them for their tuition. And that covers everything from application to their final trip home with their dog, airfare, everything. When Melissa comes back to the CNI to replace Luna, because it will be a replacement dog, those individuals are only charged $50 and veterans are only charged $1.
That's, you know, so this is another part of this thing that was an eye opener, really showed me something is, so a graduate like Melissa, an incredible young lady, you're younger than me, Melissa, and you look really young. I'm trying to do the math. I shouldn't ask a lady their age, especially on air. I should know better. But the point is that it really is striking, again, that it's $150, but the seeing eye, the actual cost, it could be with inflation. I mean, it's bananas right now.
I don't even want to think about what it's going to be.
It could be closer to $100,000, if not more, on the trajectory we're going. So how does the money get raised? I mean, who's providing the support? Because, I mean, it's a lot of money.
Yeah, you know, the majority of our support comes from individual donations from people like the listeners of the show. We do get some money from corporations and bequests and planned giving. However, the bulk of our funds comes from private individuals. A lot of people think we get government funds or that insurance would cover the cost of a CNI dog, but that's actually not true. We do not receive government funding. So those really what it comes down to is those five, ten dollar donations that the public gives us, those add up. And of course, we do have individuals who do contribute at a higher level, and we're always grateful for every little bit of support that we receive.
But once again, a lot of the money is just grassroots. People, you know,
absolutely,
are touched by the seeing eye and they want to give back not only the incredible volunteers with the puppies, which is really a beautiful thing to do, as Melissa and you have touched on. They realize they got to give like part of the family back, but they know the reason why. But so, Melissa, from your perspective, in terms of your relationship with the seeing eye, and I know you have a wonderful guide dog, and I know there's different types of dogs out there. And I don't know, you could speak a little bit, maybe Michelle, but sometimes the public gets a little confused on the type of dogs that are available for folks that need that type of service. So are there different types of dogs to help educate the public in terms of what's available?
Yes. Yeah, so essentially, it's the Americans with Disabilities Act is the federal law that protects the rights of people with service animals, and I'm using that word for a reason, to be accompanied by their service animals in public. And a service animal is a dog that's trained to perform a task for the benefit of a person with a disability. So a guide dog is a service animal. And I say animal because in rare cases you might have a miniature horse. But one of the things that people don't understand sometimes is that an animal can perform, a dog can perform a lot of different types of tasks. Guide dogs are, I think, the most commonly known type of service animal, just because we are the type that's been around the longest, right? But you know, Luna guides me, and the task that she performs is very obvious, but someone might have a disability that is not necessarily visible like mine is, and the dog, what the dog is doing is maybe a very subtle task, but they are performing a task, and that is the key in terms of what, you know, what a service animal is. As far as other types of situations, like in housing, for example, you can have an animal that mitigates someone's disability and the manifestations of their disability without the dog, the animal necessarily having to be trained to perform a task. And it doesn't even have to be a dog. So emotional support animals can give someone, maybe they have very severe depression or they have a mental health disability that makes it hard for them to just get up in the morning and do what they have to do. But having another being to care for that needs them, even if they're not actually trained to do anything, can be of great, great value. And then, of course, you have therapy dogs. And I hope Michelle can talk a little bit about that because you know a lot about that.
Sure. I volunteer with my pet dog at the Morristown Medical Center. I have a little therapy dog named Solar. And people often, when I'm at the hospital making visits, ask me if she's a seeing eye dog. And I think there's a lot of confusion, so I'm really glad we're addressing this, over the type of services dogs can perform. And a therapy dog is a dog that is trained to comfort others. So those other dogs that Melissa described are trained to help their owners or their handlers. But a therapy dog, Solar doesn't help me, although she does. I do love her very much, and she's a big part of my life. Solar is trained to greet others and make them feel comforted by her presence. And she is not granted public access by any law. She is only allowed to go where she has been invited to work.
Another thing I just want to throw out there before I forget is that, like Michelle was saying, you know, people sometimes think that Solar is a seeing eye dog. Because seeing eye dogs are really the oldest type of service animal, a lot of people don't realize that the seeing eye is a trademark. So in order to be a seeing eye dog, it has to be a dog that was bred, raised, and trained by our organization. That is true in the United States and in Canada. But a guide dog is a more general term to describe a dog that guides a person who is blind. But seeing eye dogs only come from us. And I, when I first became more acquainted with the seeing eye, ironically, as a puppy raiser, I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason why I wanted to touch on the subject. But I would be remiss, you know, I miss my parents every day. And when my mom was ill and I've had loved ones and just visited people, when the therapy dogs would walk in with their handler into that setting, it was like almost magic.
Just lights up the room.
Just being in there, everybody, dog lover or not, everybody would go over to the dog and the spirits were lifted. And I think it actually made the patient feel better.
Absolutely.
And hopefully probably healed them a little bit more. Because some people are lonely in a hospital setting at Morristown Medical, anywhere throughout our great country. Yeah. And when those therapy dogs come in, it just brings a different energy to the room. And it's kind of fascinating to me. So God bless everyone that, you know, has therapy dogs and give their time. So Melissa, because I'm a lawyer, you're a lawyer, and I would also want to explore briefly, because you are, once again, not to make you feel embarrassed, but you're very intelligent and you're very passionate. What's it like serving, you know, on behalf of the seeing eye also as an advocate and making sure the laws are in place and protecting those that need those protections?
Well, it's very, very interesting because when I was practicing law as a fair housing lawyer, I would occasionally come across these cases where someone was being denied housing or they were being denied a reasonable accommodation, which is sort of an exception that a person with a disability needs to a practice or policy. And they were being told they couldn't have their assistance animal, which is a broad term that encompasses both emotional support animals and service animals, in a housing situation. And I thought that was not right. As long as the person was legitimately a person with a disability and needed the dog or the cat or whatever it was in that circumstance, I felt very passionately about that. And then once I was matched with my seeing eye dog, Luna, that increased. And so at that point, I was practicing law in Chicago and working at a fair housing clinic. And obviously, I couldn't just do service animal cases. I had all sorts of other types of discrimination cases. And I told a friend of mine, you know, I would really like to develop more of a niche and focus a little bit more on advocating for the rights of people who have service animals. And so, but I said, but that's going to be tough because there's no job like that. It doesn't exist. And then one day I was scrolling through my inbox and this job opening popped up at the Seeing Eye, which made it tricky because I was pretty determined that I was not going to leave Chicago. At that point, I loved that city. But the seeing eye is really the only place I was really willing to relocate for, because I feel so strongly about the mission and had my life changed by it. So here at the Seeing Eye, I get to do a number of things. I provide resources and information. I have to be careful not to actually give legal representation or specific legal counsel, but I can provide information about the laws that impact a person's right to have access with their seeing eye dog. I can give them resources. I can direct them to where they might go if they do need to find an attorney. And another thing that I do is I do outreach and trainings to different entities on service animal related issues. I recently did a presentation to some building owners and managers. And that was really, I learned as much, I think, as they did in terms of just the questions that they had. We've done some outreach events. One of them was to some New Jersey state agricultural board members and to some vegetable growers. So it's amazing the types of people that I get to meet, where they're coming from and why they want to learn more about these issues. Health inspectors, it kind of runs the gamut. And then I get to do some policy and legislative work to support our graduates who are trying to make changes. So we had a graduate in Maryland who was working very, very hard to pass a guide dog protection law in Maryland so that if a guide dog was injured or harmed in some way, there would be some sort of criminal penalty. And we at the Seeing Eye, I had the opportunity to help support this graduate by offering some written and verbal testimony and having that role. And then being a spokesperson and having the opportunity to do things like this. So what I will say about my role and my experience is that I get to work for an organization whose mission has profoundly changed my life for the better. And I don't know too many people who get to say, I work for a place with a mission that has profoundly changed my life forever. I just don't know that many people who can say that. And that's something that I'm honored to be able to say.
Well, that's a beautiful thing. And that's kind of, once again, the passion you bring to the table. It's extraordinarily formidable because you live it and it's in your heart and soul. And that's a beautiful thing. A lot of people in life don't have that opportunity. So this is just wonderful, ladies. So Michelle, in terms of just if they want to reach the Seeing Eye, and I was on the website and I'm fascinated by all the wonderful stories and the mission. Is there a website they can go to also?
Yes. So our website is seeingeye.org.
So, Michelle, from your perspective, so you've been with the Seeing Eye 12 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you pick the Seeing Eye?
You know, we often say that people who are drawn to the Seeing Eye come because they love dogs. And they stay because they love the people. And that's absolutely true for me. I grew up in a dog family, training dogs, rescuing dogs, and when I saw this job, I thought, wow, how fun would it be to work at an organization that trains guide dogs and represent them? And when I came to the Seeing Eye, that was really my first time meeting and working with people who are blind. And I was so amazed at how the dogs affected their lives and really enhance their independence. And I thought, this is where I need to be. And those relationships and those friendships that I formed from working through with this organization, those are going to be with me for the rest of my life. So it's really just motivating to get up every morning and to know that your job is to make a difference and help these dogs make a difference. So I mean, that's what it is.
Well, I mean, once again, that's a blessing. Something in life, a calling, a passion to help others.
Absolutely.
Because we all have to pay the bills. We totally understand that. And that's why the show is also the journey of giving back. Because even though, you know, you're part of the Seeing Eye, you're on the journey, you're giving back. But you have an interesting perspective, Michelle, because you come across many, many graduates of the program. What is that like? I mean, do you get a feedback from the graduate? Do they write letters? Do they come back and, you know, also want to mentor others? Is there some of that also part of the CNI tradition?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of ways that our graduates help and give back to the organization. We have a lot of graduates who are donors. We have a monthly giving program, and so a lot of our graduates become monthly donors. We have auctions that our donor that our graduates both bid on to help raise funds and help organize and maybe also donate items to. The graduates are really involved in volunteering for the organization because they really want to give back.
It's a wonderful, I mean, it's a win-win. I mean, right, Melissa?
Yes.
You've been so involved. You're a graduate. You're part of the CNI. You're an advocate. You got your beautiful guide dog, Luna. And one of the things also that a lot of people want to know, because I told a lot of my friends, you ladies are coming on. I was surprised. There's an incredible amount of dog lovers. Everybody's fascinated because if you live in the area and you go through Morristown, there's a lot of folks with their guide dog handlers, maybe an instructor, and it's kind of interesting to watch folks just navigate through Morristown because it gets pretty busy, not like Chicago, but down by South Street in those areas, it gets pretty congested, a lot of bars and restaurants. So, Melissa, in terms of, let's say, Luna, you know, I know you have an incredible bond. Is there some period of time, I don't know, is it normally 10 years the dog's with you, 12 years, I guess, depending on lifestyle, where the dog then could be available for adoption? How does that work?
Yeah, so there's a range, but on average, seeing eye dogs work probably between 8 and 10 years. And that can vary in terms of, obviously, if there's a health problem or some sort of traumatic event that happens during the working relationship that, or a sensitivity that develops that causes a dog no longer to be able to work. You know, that can impact the working life of the dog, but also, so can lifestyle and the kind of stress that's on the dog. Luna has probably saved my life more times than I will ever know from being hit by vehicles that I didn't know were there, coming out of driveways or doing goodness knows what. And so that's a lot of stress on a dog. Whereas if a dog is working in an environment that maybe doesn't have as many stimuli, that may kind of increase or make it possible for the dog to work a little bit longer. I have a friend that travels all over the place for her job, and her dogs maybe work about 6 to 7 years, depending on how things go, because they're constantly moving, they're constantly on the go, whereas somebody else's dog may work for 10 years. So that really varies. But once the dog's working life is over and their retirement life begins, there are a number of things that can happen. The graduate, of course, is we own our dogs. So one of the awesome and unique things about the seeing eye is that it's not only autonomy that is fostered in terms of working with your dog on the street or in various contexts. It's also autonomy in terms of you are the keeper and carer of this dog financially, emotionally, in every way possible. So I own Luna, and so when your dog retires, it's up to you to decide, am I the right home for this dog as a pet? Can I do that? Am I allowed to have a pet dog in, you know, where I live, depending on what that looks like? Or is this dog going to be happy with me as a pet while another dog gets to go out and guide me places? What's it going to be like for that dog? And these are all things that weigh into a graduate's decision on whether or not they keep the dog or whether or not they maybe find a friend or a family member. I have lots of people lined up who would be interested in Luna if I decide that I'm unable to continue to, I can barely talk about that, but, you know, to keep her after she's done working. But if that is not an option for a graduate, the seeing eye always has our dogs. We don't leave the dogs hanging, so to speak. So even though we get to own our dogs, if we're not able to keep our dogs once they're retired, the seeing eye, we release the dog to the seeing eye, and then the seeing eye has a
group of people on staff who handle adoptions. And there's quite a lovely long waiting list of people waiting to adopt either career changed dogs who perhaps are wonderful dogs, but weren't quite cut out for the guide life at a younger age, or are wonderful older retired guides. There are people who have sort of a calling, so to speak, to be that comfortable home for the older dogs who need that.
It's wonderful. The other thing that was obviously interesting is, so these wonderful volunteers, they're raising the puppies, and then they go to the, you know, back to the seeing eye. And then from what I read, about 40% of those dogs, for whatever reason, are not a good match. How does that work, Michelle?
Yeah, so about 60% of the puppies that are born at the CNI will graduate as CNI dogs or go on into the breeding station. And the best dogs go to contribute to our breeding program so they can continue to produce better guides. And so, you know, we're breeding our dogs specifically for health, temperament, and trainability. When the dogs don't make the program, it doesn't mean necessarily that there's something wrong with the dog. When you train a dog to guide a person, that person's life is literally that dog, becomes that dog's responsibility in certain situations. And those dogs need to be trustworthy. And at the end of the day, we tell our students when they come and train with their dog, your dog is a dog first. Not every dog can overcome things that they might find distracting. And so often when dogs don't make our program, they go on to other kinds of service work. Some of them are working in local police stations. And if they don't have another job, then they're first offered back to the people who raise them because they have an emotional investment in that dog. So, and even a retired dog that returns to the CNI, we will contact the person who raised it and give them the first option to adopt the dog.
Wonderful. So the other thing, Melissa, I wanted to touch on, and this has been an incredibly, it's really an honor to have you ladies appear this morning and talk about the CNI, is the etiquette around a guide dog. Because I know, dog lover or not, when someone sees a dog that's out on the street and the dog, you know, is, even though working with the handler, people want to come up, they want to pet the dog. What's the proper etiquette? Because, you know, even this morning, I mean, everybody, you know, who knows you're with Luna wants to say hello and interact with the dog. What's the actual etiquette?
Well, Todd, I'm so glad you asked that question because it is something that a lot of people don't know. So the most important thing to remember is that while that dog is working, it absolutely has to be focused on its job. So dogs are social beings. So if somebody on the street or in another public place engages with the dog in any way deliberately, that can, and even sometimes unintentionally, that can distract the dog from its work. They are not machines. Right. They are beings just like we are, and they're bred to be dogs that are comfortable being out in public, which means that they are going to be social. So if you see a guide dog team, do everything you can, and they are cute and it is hard, to ignore the dog and engage with the handler. Because if we're at an intersection, and I had this happen to me one time where I'm standing and trying to listen to the traffic to figure out when I can cross, and someone actually squatted down, made noises, and was petting my dog. And she could not, it was hard for her to focus on getting me safely across the street because he was just trying so hard to get her attention. So that can put the life of a handler in danger. And it's not just really overt things sometimes, like feeding the dog or touching the dog. It can be making noises at the dog, and dogs will maybe try to make eye contact with you, but it's actually really important to try to avoid making that eye contact, as tempting as it is, because that can actually be a very subtle but profound way of distracting a dog that's working.
So that is like so important. So yeah. I just want to say, ladies, because we're running out of time, but we could go on and on, but I want to say God bless you. God bless the seeing eyes.
Thank you.
The fact that you are enhancing independence, enhancing dignity, enhancing self-confidence. As Morris Frank said almost a century ago, when he put his harness on his beautiful dog, Buddy, and his legs spread out. His shoulders went back. The wind hit his hair. He knew his life would never be the same. God bless everyone. Enjoy the rest of this beautiful Sunday. And never forget, we're in this together. Please tune in next week. Take care.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.